Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We come your way on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We do stream live at those times, and we also put the podcasts up on the radio show's page of richarddugan.com, as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. We also have a Facebook page. We're on Twitter, sort of, kind of, in a way. And we certainly hope that you will also go to our guest's website. We'll be giving that to you shortly, and we encourage you to investigate whatever information we have disseminated here on the program. I think that you will find it most interesting. Today especially, and in light of obviously a lot of things that have been going on around the country and around the world, and especially as it relates to not just girls, but women as well, the educational system, and also a term you may or may not have heard of, an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and math. And very interested myself in science and technology, obviously, with the advances in my particular field as well as others. Engineering, I think it's kind of fun to figure out how things were designed and where they got the ideas. And of course, math's considered to be the universal language. Well, the acronym is called STEM, and it is actually sort of a career base, if you will, that we're going to be talking about with our special guest here on the program today. Her name is Robin Pays. I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program to talk about how to succeed in these areas as we, you know, we're talking STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
It's interesting as I look at some of the information that has been shared with me that, I don't know, this math doesn't seem to add up from this standpoint, okay? Now, I'm going to read directly from this information that according to a study by the Girl Scouts, 74% of girls, I'm assuming that's under the age of 18, that they report an interest in STEM or science, technology, engineering, and math. But apparently there's a problem that when they go to pursue these careers, only 13%, I'm assuming that's 13% out of the 74, express an interest in these areas as their top career choices. And so it goes on to say that 200,000 jobs in these areas go unfilled annually. And I'm sitting here thinking about the whole unemployment issue and how it was a real big issue, of course, 2008, most recent, 2008, 9, and 10, and so forth. And of course, then we started to have this slow recovery. And I don't know if the numbers are correct or not. And again, this is overall male, female unemployment as well as employment. But if 200,000 jobs are going unfilled, is it unfilled, period, or is it unfilled by women? And how is our society even functioning if there are 200,000 jobs that are, I mean, can you imagine if 200,000 sanitation worker jobs went unfilled?
Well, we're not talking about sanitation workers,
although
they are critical to the economy. So I'm not sure that the analogy holds, but I think the interesting question that you raise about these numbers and statistics really skews towards our ideas about what STEM jobs are, and you did a great job of explaining that. In the work that I do, I even add a letter to that acronym, which is comes out as STEAM. So it's arts integration into STEM, because a lot of what STEM jobs are turning into are design oriented, and whether it's graphic design or architectural design or engineering, all require some level of artistic appreciation that goes along with it. So I've expanded that acronym a little bit. But when you ask about those jobs going unfilled, it's a matter of qualification, right? So if you get eager girls who go through up through middle school, and at that point they turn off from those math courses that are going to prepare them for those particular jobs in STEM, you know, think Silicon Valley, then they are not going to be qualified to undertake the jobs that will get them to work at Google or Facebook or those high-paying jobs that are going unfilled. And there are a lot of reasons for that, Richard, but one of them that's interesting to me is this idea that we have a societal expectation that math is hard. You know, I'm picking on math here, but it could be engineering, it could be a number of other things, science related as well. But math is hard, and girls are not scientists, or girls are not mathematicians. This is kind of a societal bias. It happens in school. It happens at home. It happens in the workforce. And it's not, it's subtle. You know, it's not like overt, oh, you can't do that because you're a girl. But there are subtle clues in the environment that say, you know, this is kind of hard, and, well, tough guys can do this job, but, you know, we don't really encourage girls to tinker and take apart, you know, the old idea of the kid who is an inveterate inventor and taking apart toasters and microwaves and rebuilding them. Those don't sound like girl hobbies or girl activities, typically. And so part of what this redress, you know, this idea that we're missing people for jobs is about really what we expect girls to do or how girls should behave in society. I will say that's changing slowly, and there's a lot of support out there. There are a lot of activities and after-school enrichment programs for girls, particularly in STEM and STEAM careers or interests. But it's still not at the level that we'd like to see to reach, and I really don't like this word, but I'll say it anyway, parity with boys and men mm-hmm. for those careers. And there is workplace bias as well. You know, Google has struggled for years to attract a more diverse workforce. And then was it last summer they had some engineer at Google wrote a memo that went to their intranet, their listserv, you know, sort of castigating women, saying they weren't qualified. And that raised a huge, huge brouhaha around the topic. So it still exists in 2018, which is kind of shocking if you think about it.
Well, it is shocking. And the thing that, you know, you use the word parody, which I know you hate to use. I have a hard time with the concept when I hear the stories of the same job that is performed by both men and women, and it might even be in the same company, and yet the woman was hired and is automatically paid less than the man. And I cannot wrap my brain around that.
Join the club, Richard. Yeah. I'm right there with you.
Either the job pays $25 an hour, period, or it doesn't. It doesn't matter who's doing it. The only caveat would be whether or not that person, male or female, is a qualified or has the full capacity and capability to perform that job, or needs further training, etc., or has no aptitude whatsoever for it and shouldn't have been hired for that job in the first place. And I have to tell you that in my days of hiring, which I'm out of those days in one sense, I preferred hiring women in the first place because they seemed to get it mentally what we were doing at the radio stations I was working for. Whereas a lot of the guys, their egos kept getting in the way. And that's what really bugged the heck out of me. Plus the fact that there were so few female voices on the air doing commercials and things of this nature. And that's what that's the diversity that I wanted, because there were already so many males.
What about the engineers, you know, audio engineers?
Yeah.
Were they behind that board also? Really?
I did have one gal. I trained her for like a month. And then I let a let her loose on the board for a weekend shift. She said she was ready. From all intents and purposes, as her supervisor, it seemed like she was ready. I felt that she was good to go. Sadly, come Monday morning, she had just about trashed that eight-hour shift in terms of us having to issue credits to most of the programmers because of the mistakes that she made on those programs. That was a very isolated incident and not indicative of the other women. And I had a number of them that were working with me. I don't want to say for me because I was not the employer. I was just the supervisor. But I was doing the same job they were. And to me, that is what a supervisor should be doing, not sitting in their office filling out paperwork. They should be doing the same job that the people they're working, that they're supervising are doing, so they know what the heck they're doing.
Yeah. But anyway,
I applaud you. You know, I applaud you for going to that extent and you know, for even giving that one sound engineer an opportunity. And of course, we know men and women both can succeed or fail at a job and for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's exclusive to one woman.
No.
But I do think that overall, as a society, we haven't really made the strides to understand what, you know, take your example of the workplace, what the environment is like. You know, I think we've seen in the Me Too movement now just a groundswell of women's voices where they were afraid to speak out before, and now for a variety of reasons, they're feeling that they have to tell their stories publicly,
yeah,
so that they'll be heard. And these are not, you know, these are not unusual. These are not Hollywood stories. They're stories across America, honestly.
Well, I have to say, first of all, and I hear the, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I hear the angst in your voice over this subject, especially when you consider the fact that it is a male who is doing the interviewing here. But my frustration as a male is on two levels. One is during my dating years, I was frustrated over the women I came across who had been through abusive situations. And of course, now I'm dating them and they have been damaged, and now I have to deal with the damage and trying to help them through those periods of time while also trying to establish some level of a relationship. And the same kind of thing goes on to a lesser degree in the workplace when you are hiring individuals. And I was interviewing a woman from Karachi, Pakistan, not too long ago, Bina Shah. And she says, well, you know, she says, we run into men who are damaged too. So, you know, it plays both sides of the street. But the other frustration is in being a man and hearing these stories from the Me Too movement and so forth. And I realize we're getting a little off the track to some degree. Being afraid to be a man these days and not wanting to get anywhere near women, because the last thing I want is to be accused of something that I had, you know, I didn't do anything. I looked over there. Oh, hello. And then I looked back and I went on my way. But now I'm being accused of whatever it is that I'm being accused of.
Now, this could be a whole other radio show,
sure,
Richard.
Sure.
I think it's very fruitful. It's a big question.
Yeah.
And I do think men are a little bit afraid also.
Yeah.
Understandably, because the roles are changing, yeah, and all of that. But to get back to what we were trying to ferret out about, you know, about women and jobs in some of these high paying STEM and STEAM, mm-hmm, capacities, I think that part of what we are trying to do, what I'm trying to do with my project, Edge of Yesterday, which is a book series, a time travel book series for teens.
Edge of Yesterday, right?
Edge of Yesterday, and mm-hmm, a learning website at www.edgeofyesterday.com that is a platform about learning through story, is to change the conversation a little bit and also help to change the climate. So the climate that might be conducive to supporting young girls and women who are coming up and learning the skills and the knowledge that will prepare them for those STEM and STEAM careers might be better served if we take a different approach.
Yeah.
You know, if we kind of look at it differently to understand what a supportive environment for women would be, and would that also be supportive for men in the workplace, in school, in college, in wherever we are. And it's really fundamentally changing the paradigm, I think. So Edge of Yesterday is really kind of at the cutting edge of doing that. And we do it through stories. So the Teen Time Travel Adventure, this Edge of Yesterday book series, and I have a second book in the series, Da Vinci's Way, that's coming out this fall, is about a STEM smart girl, or a STEAM smart girl, actually, because she's also a musician, who finds Leonardo da Vinci's plans for a time machine, and for the middle school science fair, she decides to build it.
Oh,
and
wow.
her goal is to, of course, win the science fair, but also, you know, her deeper goal in life, the meaning that she's looking for, she wants to do it all. She wants to be kind of a modern day Renaissance girl like Leonardo was. And she doesn't want to just be, let's say, a sound engineer. She wants to be a sound engineer who also plays the violin, who also records her own music, who also writes the music. You know, she has a lot of things she wants to accomplish. So her goal in trying to invent Leonardo's time machine, and you know, of course, he was this amazing artist, but he was also an inventor, an engineer, an architect, a sculptor, a musician, an anatomist, you name it, mm-hmm. is to learn the secrets of Leonardo's success. And so when the time machine works, you know, there's a bump, there's a kiss, there's a little romance, because this, we're talking about teens here. And we want them to be engaged in the story. We want to make it realistic for teens to get involved in this. And she ends up wending her way back 500 years across six time zones to land in an empty field at midnight under a hail of cannon fire and to meet Leonardo himself face to face. So that's the setup for the story. And once Charlie, is her name, Charlie Morton, once Charlie is back in Renaissance Florence and meeting with her Renaissance idol Leonardo himself, she wants to learn all his secrets because she wants to take that back to the 21st century and become a modern day Leonardo.
Well, I have to say that I have been a very strong advocate of education for all, but in our conversation here, especially for the girls in our country in particular, let alone around the world. I'm appalled at some of the news stories that I hear that they do every so often about the lack of parity of education. And so you are doing this through, your website. And again, this is the, edgeofyesterday.com. Is that correct?
Correct. Edgeofyesterday.com.
And we encourage people to go to that website. We will be linked to it as well. And we encourage people to go there and continue. It's an interactive experience, correct?
Yes. Yes. We aim for engagement because I'll tell you my background a little bit. I'm, in addition to an author, I'm a science writer, and I write often about neuroscience. And I have a special fascination for teen brains, so teen developmental neuroscience. And we know that learning is best when it's engaged and when it's interactive. And so on this website, visitors will find stories that are related to the time travel adventures, these books, Edge of Yesterday and Da Vinci's Way, but also grow out of them. And they all have, there's a lot of good content there that's, here's the criteria I use because these are our young teens that are the main target audience. They have to be funny, scary, stupid, gross, or just fun. So the stories incorporate a lot of those qualities to make them engaging. But they have quizzes, and kids can earn badges by taking the quizzes, and the quizzes show how learning is interrelated. So in school, you know, you talked about the education system. In school, you might have science at 9 o'clock, at 10 o'clock you have Spanish, at 11 o'clock you have history, and none of these seem related to each other or to your own life. And I think that inhibits learning. So what we're aiming to do is showing how everything is interconnected. And of course, this was intrinsic to the way Leonardo da Vinci saw the world. Everything is connected. And asking questions, being curious, and learning how to kind of look in unusual places to see how things work is what his lesson was all about. That's what Charlie learns in her adventures with Leonardo, or part of it anyway. And so that's what we're hoping to bring out and enhance the educational experience by making it relatable to your life and to the world.
Well, I have to say I'm excited about the prospects for our future when we're talking about this whole area, because without people getting the education necessary to not just do the jobs, but be creative. We talk about giving people choices and knowledge of those choices on this program. And if you don't know that you have those choices, you can't choose them. You know, and we use the analogy of walking on this this road day after day, and this is these are the instructions that are given by the village, if you will. Okay, when you head to work or school, you follow the white line on the right-hand side of the road. Just follow that, and you'll get to your destination. When you come home, it's now going to be on your left, and you follow it home, and you get home. Now, as you're traveling, there's this heavy fog, which is the reason why you have to focus on the white line. One day, as you're walking, the fog lifts, and suddenly you see a fork in the road. Well, gee, you could choose to go down that other fork in the road. Stop following the white line. You can always come back to it. But, gee, that would be interesting to see what's down that way. But you didn't know it was there until the fog lifted, and that's what we're talking about on this program. And that's what you're talking about in a really big way. Now, can you tell me how long has this program has been around for how long?
Well, it's been around. Let me start with the book series. So, in about 15 years ago, when my kids were kind of entering their teen years, and I was the carpool soccer mom, driving everyone, them and their friends, to their lessons in soccer and band and school, etc. I would listen in on their backseat conversations, and they were all talking about, the usual things like which teacher was mean or giving the hard quiz, and who was hanging out with whom. But also they were talking about all the things they wanted to be and do when they grew up. And it wasn't one thing. It was always, well, I want to be a star saxophone player, and I want to play lacrosse, and I also want to be a neurosurgeon. You know, they all had big dreams. And so this occurred to me as a thought experiment. Is there, you know, we force kids to specialize early. If you're not playing French horn in kindergarten, you're not going to get into Stanford, and you're not going to get the right connections and the right jobs. So it began as a thought experiment. Was there ever any time in history when people were encouraged to do it all? And of course, Leonardo da Vinci comes to mind as the ultimate Renaissance genius himself. And so it was really, the story started as a thought experiment. And I wrote it first as a screenplay, which I still have, but I'm not connected to Hollywood. And that's a very hard road when you don't have the right connections. So talking to some of my advisors, they said, you know, you'd have better luck bringing this out as a novel. And so thus began the novelization of my screenplay. And so the novel was the three-part Leonardo series was finished in 2013. I'm bringing them out one at a time, the books out one at a time. So one book is out now, the second is coming out October, and the third will come out in another 18 months or so. And then as it grew, I realized that it left me with a lot of questions. And as I talked about it more to kids, because I do a lot of work with teens, and I had at the time teens of my own to consult with, they were the experts, it occurred to me that there was a lot more that we could do online and through social media to make it interactive and engaging. And so it wasn't just a question of putting together a reader's guide or, you know, a teacher's guide, although I do have those things. But it was also a question of how to get kids engaged offline, or how to get kids into what you were discussing before, this idea of creativity and curiosity, which I think are essential to being a Leonardo da Vinci today, because we can't all be the genius artist that he was, but we can all be more curious. So I'll give you an example. I heard Walter Isaacson speak when his book, his biography of Leonardo, came out last fall or last winter. And he said one of the things that struck him in doing research for the book and looking at Leonardo's, these codices, these the codex that Leonardo's doodles and thoughts and drawings are, and there are about 13,000 pages of those that we know of, and there are presumed others that we don't even know of or that may have been destroyed. He was quite prolific. One of the notes that Walter Isaacson pointed out that he loved most was, describe a woodpecker's tongue. Now, who thinks of that? Describe a woodpecker's tongue. I love it. So what the answer is, a woodpecker's tongue wraps around its head, so when it's pecking on a tree, it protects the brain. So are there implications there for traumatic brain injury, protecting our athletes who have these head injuries? I don't know. Isn't that interesting to think about? I was talking to someone yesterday who, here in Maryland, where I live, is involved in out of school programming for young people, and who we'll be collaborating with. And she said the first question that came to her mind was, What does the tongue taste like? What does the tongue feel like around the brain? And I just thought that was great. So 1,000 questions can come out of the simple idea, describe a woodpecker's tongue.
Well, and again, this is the antithesis, if you will, of creativity, is that we see all kinds of things around us and we start putting those things together and we come up with new and or innovative and or creative ideas that spur new ones and new ones after that and new ones after that, which gets me to an area that I find interesting, and that is this whole argument over intellectual property rights. And it's like, well, nothing is designed and or developed and or created from a vacuum. Everything that exists in the 21st century had its roots in the past. So what are we going to do? Start paying royalties to the people who developed all of the previous inventions that led up to whatever it is that we're playing with today? I get to a point.
Well, fortunately, fortunately, the patent laws expire after 50 years and copyrights expire after 50 years. So unless it's in somebody's estate, then it's open season. It's open to all.
Yeah. But I'm not talking.
And there also is today more than ever is this idea of open source. You know, when you talk, when you talk about coding and things like that, there are people who leave things open source or Creative Commons for photography or writing that people will share freely with attribution. So there are more ways of using things. But of course, Leonardo is 500 years dead. So I don't think we have to worry about plagiarizing him. just saying. But he was exceptional in that he thought about, how do birds' wings feather when they're in flight?
Yeah.
What lifts them, you know? He designed a helicopter.
Yeah, I saw
He didn't
that.
Have the technology for it, but he designed the idea of something that could lift and hover and fly.
One of the aspects that you brought up as far as birds are concerned is I sit out at the breakwater here in Santa Barbara, and I watch a flock of birds go by, and my curiosity is as to how it is that they know to fly in that particular formation and stay that way for a long period of time. I mean, and I've watched other documentaries that have sort of focused on this. And to me, that's just fascinating how they're individual birds, but somehow, some way they know collectively, this is the way we fly.
This is just
well,
what
and
we
how
do
these birds that fly super long distances in different seasons, how do they know where to go? Some of them have never done that trek before, and yet they seem to have an instinctive
They've got great GPS, all I can tell you.
That's true. Better than what we got, huh?
I remember when I was using my GPS on my phone for the first time. The warning came up because it was the first time I'd used it. It said, at that time, it said that your location may be within 100 yards of your actual location. And so we're traveling down the freeway, and I kept getting instructions from the GPS on how to get back on the freeway. Well, I had never left.
So it's gotten better, fortunately.
Well, this whole process really does, or does it start with the educational system, or does it start earlier than that?
Well, to me, it starts earlier than that. So, another previous part of my career, I was editor in chief of a learning portal on the science of learning. It's really about mind-brain education, and we wrote a lot. We had a lot of articles about and content about early childhood, and the key to learning in early childhood, and I would say it's not only early childhood, but we can discuss that if you'd like, is play. Sure. That's how we learn, is play. Yeah. And discovery and just following your instincts. I think we would do well to allow kids the time and freedom to do more of that. Now, kids, you know, starting in first grade and maybe even earlier, are so programmed from sunup to bedtime that they don't have the time to roam outside and just explore, to be in nature, to socialize with their friends and run around outside. And they're also so tuned into their devices. And sometimes that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes it's at the exclusion, to the exclusion of other free time that's unstructured, that, you know, I can even remember growing up when I would say I'm bored. Kids are never bored now because they're programmed every minute of the day, but sometimes boredom spurs innovation.
Yeah.
And new ideas.
Well, I know that people talk to me a lot about retirement, for example, and I say the only retiring I will be doing is, of course, on my car. And my retirement plan is Goodyear, or it's whatever other manufacturer there is. Because if I were to retire, I don't know what, I would go nuts. I need that environment where I can be doing something that also spurs a certain level of creativity, especially, for example, around the house. If I've got some time off and I'm at home, and if we're not, you know, maybe traveling somewhere, I will be puttering around the house, and I'll find these miscellaneous parts, and I'll think, gee, I wonder, you know, we need to do this, that, or the other thing, and I wonder how these might play into that. Or I need to solve this particular problem around the house. Maybe there's a step that needs to be fixed up, and so forth. And I'm no carpenter, but I'm also a very firm believer in the measure twice, cut once rule. So I will scrutinize and scrutinize and scrutinize before I begin diving into cutting and pasting and so forth. I did that with cutting down some dead trees around our property. I actually went out there one afternoon, and I spent a half hour trying to figure out where to place the ladder and how high I need to go up to cut this thing so that it would fall where I wanted it to. It wouldn't injure or kill me or destroy something on the ground. And after the half hour, I could not, for the life of me, figure it out. So I said, hey, I'm calling in a day. I went in the house. Next day I went out, I was able to figure out, okay, this is where I need to do it. And it worked fine.
Yeah, well, you bring up a really good point there, which is sometimes when you're so focused on a problem that the answer won't come, you just need to go away and do something else. And then it's like, oh, yeah, it just comes, you know, it's that eureka moment. Oh, yeah, that's how it goes. And so that's a great example of that. Yeah. But I would take it one step further even, which is, you know, let's say you were, you cut down this tree, and there's the log lying there. If you were Michelangelo, let's say, what would you free from that log? What sculpture could you create out of that? So I would take it even further.
Yeah,
I would say.
I like that. Isn't that one of those phrases or sayings supposedly taken from one of these great sculptors that says, well, you know, how do you know? you know, what to do. I said, well, I just chip away everything that's not whatever it is that they're trying to create.
Right. That is Michelangelo. That was how he created the David out of a marble stone, you know, a marble block. It was just waiting to be liberated.
I have to joke about, for example, the old carburetor in older vehicles. And I've seen one, and I've seen people who have worked on them. I'm no mechanic either, but I've learned an awful lot over the years. And I take a look at that device, and I'm going, you know, the guy that designed and developed that thing had way too much time on his hands. Because, I mean, that thing is so complicated. It works. It does its job. I don't know what that job is, but it works. It's just fascinating how people come up with these. When people come up with new musical instruments, and I'm not talking electronic necessarily. I'm talking about the wide and diverse types of handheld, wind, string, percussion types of instruments. It's just amazing.
I'll give you two perfect examples in my research about Leonardo for that. So the first is that of the General Motors, original General Motors engine in a car, let's say of 100 patented innovations, 99 of those were Leonardo da Vinci's.
Wow.
Think about that. 400 years before the automobile. So that's that's one thing. And he also created his own. He designed an instrument that was kind of a combination of a wind instrument and a string instrument. I'm not remembering the name of it now, although I'm looking it up as we go. But somebody in Poland has created from Leonardo's designs this instrument and plays it around the world. Let's see. It's called a viola organista. So it's a combination of viola and an organ.
Well, I used to train on that as an 8-year-old. No, I did take the violin. I did take piano lessons. I played the baritone in high school. My dad tried to teach me the harmonica and the ukulele. None of it took. But that's fascinating. Like I said, where these ideas come from. And without being exposed to much of this, again, when you expose girls to these ideas. Now, I know that this is an online program. I know this is online interactive. But are you traveling about and having face-to-face and one-on-one or group gatherings in different parts
of
the country?
Sure, yes. I do workshops and I speak to groups of girls all over. In fact, I'm working with somebody in Northern California right now to create a program that will be going through the Boys and Girls Clubs. We're a pilot program.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about that when we get back from break, because this is very exciting stuff. To be honest with you, I'm thrilled because everybody deserves a full and fruitful education. And unfortunately, our current system, it's got some problems. We're not going there, but you are, and the work that you are doing, and people like you, Robin, you are helping the process to evolve to a new level, and we're very excited about that. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. We are talking here on the program, and again, I am very excited about this. We are talking with our special guest here on the program, Robin Pays, in regards to STEM, and as well as her website, which, of course, we encourage you to go to edgeofyesterday.com. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Please stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're here with Robin Pays. We're talking about STEM, which is for science, technology, engineering, and math. Now, you used another term, STEAM. What was music an extra M, and that's why it's STEAM?
No, arts is the A in
oh,
STEAM.
Oh, arts. I beg
so
your pardon.
That includes music, of course.
Absolutely.
And all kinds of arts, whether they're graphic arts or fine arts or, you know, sculpture or writing or poetry. There's just the whole world in the arts.
Would I be Would I be inaccurate to say that if they were to do away with all of the basic courses in school, and I'm talking about math and science, those kinds of basics, okay, but they kept all of the arts and the creative aspects, wouldn't it be true that along the path of those, some people call them electives or extracurriculars like music and so forth and art, wouldn't there be along the way the learning of all of these other elements of English and grammar and so forth and mathematics and what have you? Because in music, you have the various measures and so forth. When you are trying to build something, you have to start using a ruler. So now you've got to start using basic math, but also now you're going to be incorporating geometry. I don't know where calculus comes into this, unless you want to send a rocket to the moon and trigonometry and so forth. But would I be remiss in making that analogy that even if they did away with all of the basics, if they kept all of the arts programs and so forth, nobody's going to be left out in the cold because you're going to be picking that stuff up along the way because that's part of the practical application of the art that you're into.
I think that's a fascinating question, Richard, and maybe there would be a rubric or a lens we could create where arts is the entry into all of this. I think that's a fascinating idea. I would say that the scientists and engineers in the world or technologists might get upset if you took away calculus and differential equations and coding and all of those things. But it could certainly be a portal through which we could encourage greater knowledge in all of those things. I would say a balance is necessary. So really, you can't do away with those basic subjects, but you can take a different entry point to get into them. And arts is one way. But, we live in a scientific world. That's how our worldview has evolved, and it's the way we kind of make the physical world relatable or understandable. And I don't think that's the only way, certainly until the 17th, early 18th century, that was not the standard. Faith and religion might have been more of the standard in those times before the scientific revolution and the industrial revolution took over. I would say that we may have reached a turning point where we are ready and ripe for seeing the world in a different way. And to me, arts is certainly a facet of it. It may be that we are now entering a time, just beginning to enter a time where the quantum realm, sort of understanding the non-material world is going to be that lens through which we start to learn about things beyond the physical. And of course, for that, quantum science or quantum physics requires math that I have no access to or no aptitude for. Mm-hmm. So it's more than theoretical, but having the level of sophistication to kind of prove these theories, that explain the quantum world, really does require some level of technical understanding and advanced mathematical learning.
Well, I'm not advocating that necessarily. I'm being more facetious because usually I will make that statement facetiously when people talk about cutting different programs in the educational system. And usually it's the arts and physical education and so forth that are the things that
You're speaking to what we value as a society. And those are things that are not valued. Even those people who are practicing artists or practicing musicians, unless they're at the top of their game and the most talented people, they have a hard time making a living, and yet they have a great contribution to make to our society. In fact, I think it's more valuable today to gaze at a painting or to sit through a symphony than it ever has been in the past, just because we're so deprived of that aesthetic beauty. in our very workaday world, where numbers and politics and other things rule.
Yeah.
I think we've gotten away from all of that is a short way of saying it. And so I agree with you. Yeah, we need more.
And I have to compliment and applaud my grade school for their using a program in the music class, which I thought was really cool. It's what gave me the great appreciation for and a rather large collection of classical music CDs. They had a thing called music memory. And the way it worked was at the beginning of the semester, you were going to be listening to various pieces of music by various composers. And you were to memorize those pieces and, of course, associate the composer and other information. And at the end of the semester, if you were able to pass the test that was given, then, and I was born and raised in Phoenix, you would get to go to Grady Gamage Auditorium on the ASU campus, and you would be able to sit and listen to the Phoenix Symphony Orchestra play many of these pieces in that incredible acoustically designed facility. Not just getting out of class, mind you, but it, and I hadn't really thought about it for a long time, but I thought, my gosh, they were teaching a whole lot more than just developing my memory. And you know, you could start going down the list of those different things, because we started talking about some of these other things, which develops a lot of questions that I've asked of musicians and composers on various programs over the years about how they create and their influences and so on and so forth. So, you know, these seemingly innocuous little things can actually have a very profound difference in an individual's life. And speaking of which, you've got these programs that you are putting on associated with, you said, the Boys and Girls Clubs that you're going around to. And I was going to ask you before the break, wanted to ask you in reference to the kind of initial reception that you get, and then the kind of reception you get following the presentation.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you ask that, because I just came back from Chautauqua, New York, which I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with Chautauqua, but it is kind of a, I call it Shangri-La. It's a town that comes to life in the summer, and it has music, arts, ballet, theater, but also all these great speakers come to Chautauqua from all over the country and talk about a different theme every week. The first week this year of the summer was the life of the written word, and I was invited to teach a class to teens about oral history storytelling. So, and we turned them into podcasts. So what we worked on with my group was we had some people whose families had been coming to Chautauqua since its founding in the 1870s. So a long time, and how they spent their summers and how it was different for teens today to spend their summers. What were the different customs and what was the same? And so these 12 and 13, 14 year olds in the class learned interview techniques, so oral histories. And then we went into the archives and the library at Chautauqua to do research about the history, you know, and find fun things like, so both of the longtime Chautauquans who agreed to be interviewed for our podcast series wanted to talk about the time during World War II, their time at this Chautauqua institution during World War II. And so we went into the archives and we found the daily newspaper that still comes out every day during the summer season. We looked at archived copies of the Chautauqua Daily, and there were ads in there for women's dresses for $2.99 and men's fine suits for $6. And so that was like a kind of a shocker to them. But in doing these interviews, they learned good interview techniques, and they also learned how life was different and the same from what they experienced today. So the kids themselves did the interviews. We were in the radio studio there on the grounds and recorded these interviews with them. And it was interesting because we did a little bit of a roundtable afterwards where I asked the kids what they got out of it. This was the first time it was being offered. It was actually a STEAM program, which Chautauqua offered for the first time this summer. And they were funny because they said, well, what we learned is you've got to give these things a chance because it may sound boring, but it really turned out to be fun. And I really learned a lot. So it was not necessarily the first thing they wanted to do on their summer vacation, but they really got a lot out of it. And it was a lot of fun to put together. And I learned, as I always do working with these kids, I learned a lot from them as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds to me like you learned, you had a great an educational experience as they did. And I have to say, that is probably what makes some of our better educators, is those who really are, they're in the process of learning even as they're teaching. It's like we're both teacher and student regardless of age. I'm sure that's the way you look at these young people, that they're sort of, they're your teacher as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I love working with these kids. It's such a great age. And to some extent in camp programs and enrichment programs, it's an overlooked period because the programs tend to be geared towards younger kids. So when it gets to, sort of these tweens and young teens, the programs aren't necessarily geared specifically for them. So when I get to create something like that, I really enjoy getting to know them and learn more about them and really to help find out what makes them tick. I think I mentioned that Edge of Yesterday, the interactive website, is about learning through story. And so what I learn a lot about is hearing other people's stories, and especially these kids. And sometimes after we've worked together for a while, they actually are able to change parts of their story that they don't like. It empowers them to say, wow, you know, I could make a podcast, and that was kind of fun. It's something I've never done before. So I get a lot of satisfaction out of really listening to them, because they're often not listened to, but then kind of feeding that forward and saying, look what's possible, look what we could do together.
And you are also showing them something that maybe they're not getting in their personal lives, and that's a level of respect. You have a respect for them as individuals, not just as kids.
Right, absolutely. You know, even the youngest people are people first. They're not clay that we mold, and we know from many, many years of research on child development that they come in with their own quirks and their own interests and their own passions and their own problems. And the best we can hope to do is really to influence that on the positive side of things. And so that's what I hope to bring into the lives of these kids. And I love the younger kids, but somehow this age group, Richard, really speaks to me. I really get into it because they are coming up with novel ideas, and you can get into really good conversations with them, and they have their own thoughts about things that are original, you know, that I haven't heard before. I don't hear speaking about with my adult friends. And so perhaps they have solutions or ideas about how to solve problems that that my generation has kind of come up empty on.
You know, that to me is one of the greatest benefits of giving someone an education, again, a full education. It's in a way sad, some of the things that we have to focus on in our primary and secondary, as well as post-secondary institutions, that takes us away from the educational process. Like, you know, okay, what happens if some intruder enters the facility? What do we do? And bullying and those kinds of things. These all take away from that whole process of learning and being creative and so forth. And so, again, I'm just really excited about the prospects that are out there. You in particular, Robin, and the work that you're doing. I'm curious as to who are your collaborators? Who's working with you on these programs? Are there other programs across the country? And is this something that is maybe going global as well? Because we all know that even though we might fall in, we're down the line as far as our level of educating our youth, by comparison to the rest of the world, you know, maybe there are things that we could learn from other places as well.
Sure. Well, it's funny you should ask that. Of course, because of this time travel facet to my series, it could be anywhere at any time that we go. And it's funny that you ask if this could be international, because I'm actually going to be in France next month in September, where the new adventure I'm working on, which is the fourth book in the series, is for an 18th century physicist, mathematician, philosopher who translated Newton into French, and in addition, they still use today. She lived in the Enlightenment, laid the foundation for relativity two centuries before Einstein, and she was the mother of four and the consort of Voltaire. She dueled in the court of Louis XV and won to earn money for textbooks and tutors, and no one has ever heard of her. So this woman, Emily du Châtelet, who I am writing this new book for, around, Charlie's Adventure to Meet Her, and there is was a real-life person, of course, and every year on September 10th, which is the date of her death, in the town where she's buried, they have a festival. And I have been invited to do a reading in English and in French from this new book. So, yes, Charlie and Edge of Yesterday are going around the world, and I'm very excited about the prospects of bringing this to audiences and readers in other countries as well.
That is fantastic. Now, do you just read French, or do you speak French as well?
I speak and read French. I was a French major in college, believe it or not. So I studied in France, and it's really the language I love, and it's where I learned to write, because French has rules and English doesn't, so it made it a lot easier to learn to write in French, to write well in French,
and then
the English came second.
Yeah, I met an Italian exchange student here in Santa Barbara, and when we got to talking, she shared with me that just in her primary and secondary coursework there in Italy before she became an exchange student, she was already speaking five different languages, including English.
I think that's fantastic.
Then she came to the United States. She came to Santa Barbara. She begins going through the community college process. She's learning two other languages, Chinese, I think, and Russian.
Wow.
Now, that's where I think that our American educational system is really deficient, because there's so much more we could learn from other people in other countries if we could just speak their language and understand them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is that Emily du Châtelet, this new novel I'm working on, and Voltaire, who they lived and worked together for 10 years and fought and really had a passionate relationship, they spoke to each other in English.
Oh, wow.
Go figure. Yeah, go figure. Who
Interesting.
Knew?
Now,
also, there have been a few movies out recently, and one of them is, the title is escaping me. I mean, it was Hidden Numbers or something like that.
Secret Numbers.
Hidden Figures.
Hidden figures.
And as I'm watching this, and of course, this is based upon a true story of these women, you know, black women in and of that, but women in general, they were, the way they were portrayed in the movie, they were the backbone of the space program. Because without them, these men with their massive egos would never have figured a lot of this stuff out.
Right, right. Well, they are not the only hidden figures, women who have contributed significantly to the advancement of science and technology and engineering and math, in addition to the arts and the humanities. It's just that their stories have not been told before now, but we're starting. Isn't that the great news? We're starting.
Absolutely.
There's another great documentary out that I would recommend highly. It's called Bombshell, and it's the story of Hedy Lamarr. Hedy Lamarr, the most beautiful woman in the world, a Hollywood star of the 40s and 50s, was a scientist and an engineer, and she invented the technology that today we find in Bluetooth and GPS and Wi-Fi, and got no credit for it. She invented it and gave it to the Navy, to detect submarines during World War II. It was part of the war effort. And they basically said to her, well, that's very nice, little lady, but you go and raise some money for the war effort and we'll take care of the hard stuff.
Wow. Wow.
She wasn't recognized for it until the 1990s.
I didn't know that at all. Wow. It is truly amazing the deficiencies of our educational system, because there's another aspect of our history here on the Central Coast I didn't know about until I moved here. You know, we were all taught as a kid growing up, at least in my neck of the woods, the Southwest, that the Japanese never reached the U.S. mainland. But when I moved to Santa Barbara, I found out that they had. And that there was an event that happened literally along the Central Coast that somehow frightened the particular Japanese soldiers who came ashore to get back in their boat and head back to their submarine or their ship or what have you, and go on. But apparently there were some other things that happened as well. And we were never told this kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it's those untold stories that really are fascinating, right?
Yeah.
And there's just whole worlds that we have yet to tap into in our past, but also that can help shape the present and the future in ways that are a little different than maybe the trajectory we're on now. And let's uncover those.
Absolutely.
I think that would be exciting.
And who knows what we'll uncover and discover could lead to new innovations in ways in which to live on this planet, and the ways in which to solve some of the problems, as you mentioned earlier, solve some of the problems that we have to face right now. And, you know, it shouldn't matter the gender from which the idea comes, but the fact that the idea has come and that we can use it.
So with Edge of Yesterday, that's what I'm hoping to inspire. Let's get the Leonardo da Vinci's of tomorrow. Let's get those brains and gear and get them wondering and curious, but give them the foundation so that they have that STEM and STEAM background that allows them to then dream the future into life. How exciting can that be?
Oh, it's, you know, I can't say enough about the work that you're doing. I think it's fantastic, and I applaud you and the folks that you have surrounded yourself with. And I also applaud all of the girls who are participating in this program for doing so, because, again, as you mentioned earlier in the program, there are a lot of other distractions that keep them from wanting, even considering going in this particular direction. And I've often thought that one of the only reasons why many of the entitlement programs even exist is because it's been ingrained almost genetically from one generation to the next that this is the only choice we have. But you and STEM are showing that it isn't the only choice that you have. There are limitless choices, but unless the door is open, and boy, I think you took the door off the hinges is what I think you've done, which is fantastic.
I like to say, you know, some people say that they think outside the box. Well, I don't even see there's a box.
Ah, yes.
I like that. I like that very much. Robin, I want to thank you so much for giving us so much time here on the program to share with our listeners about all of this. This is exciting news. I can't say enough about what you are doing with STEM and STEAM. I almost said STEM and Stern, but nonetheless, let's steam ahead with the possibility that we could, you know, just we could go places that we've never been before, whether it's outer space or inner space for that matter. So again, I thank you so much and encourage people to go to your website, which is edgeofyesterday.com. It's more than a website. It's an interactive experience and journey, and we encourage everyone, young and old, to go there and see what it's all about. And again, I thank you so much for joining us. And should you find yourself out here on the West Coast in the Central California area, preferably in non-fire season, which
it's year-round now, but
when there's not so much smoke in the air, we'd love to have you in studio to talk more about this, because this is a very important subject that needs to be continued to be talked about.
Well, thank you so much. I look forward to that.
And before we let you go, I have three final questions. And again, thank you so much for the time. First question is, who is Robin Pays?
Oh, boy. That's not a simple question. Robin Pays is a writer, a dreamer, and inspired to bring the next generation the best possible conditions for them to bring their own dreams to life.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I really hope that we can work to evolve our educational system, the way we raise children, to bring out all of the potential that exists in the world. I'll explain a little bit quickly. So for someone going into kindergarten today, half the jobs in the world will not exist when they become adults, and the other half haven't been invented yet. So how do you prepare a young person for jobs that don't even exist now? And to me, that's learning how to learn, unlearn, and relearn. I am paraphrasing an Alvin Toffler quote, but if we can give them the tools to be able to learn through the lifetime and to be curious and remain open to new ideas, I think that will be a great legacy.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
I think my life's purpose is just to shine a light for young people, both for them and with them, to enhance our way of being in the world, to give us a new view of how things are and how they can be.
And who knows, some of these girls might actually create some of the new jobs that don't even exist today.
Hear, hear.
That would be very cool. Robin Pays, thank you again for joining us. And again, the website, edgeofyesterday.com. Encourage you to go there and check out this incredible science fiction story as well. I tell you what, I'm looking forward to seeing it on the big screen, if not even the small screen.
Thank you. Thank you. If you have some friends in Hollywood, just pass along the book and let's talk.
I have to tell you, even as you were describing it, I was running the film in my head. I could see the various images, and that was very cool. Matter of fact, when my wife and I were reading the Audible version of The Da Vinci Code, I was running that in my head as we were driving back and forth from Phoenix to Santa Barbara when we still lived in Phoenix. Then when the movie came out, I was blown away at how close my film was in my head to that of the film on the screen. And the look of the character that Tom Hanks played was almost identical. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool.
There's the power of the imagination, Richard. You brought your vision to life. That's excellent.
And I wasn't even trying.
Again, Robin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, get an education and tune in next time. Until then, love Talal.